Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possible motivations behind the bombings in Boston as indications emerge that the terrorists might have acted out of hatred not of America but of American foreign policy. Dr. John Mueller, the author of Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, and Terror, Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits and Costs of Homeland Security, joins us to discuss the trillion-dollar anti-terrorism boondoggle that once again failed to stop a terrorist act. Then we'll look into the push to try the surviving terrorist as an enemy combatant and what is behind the efforts to keep Guantanamo going, even though the president has vowed to close it, and it has become a symbol of our international disgrace as America's gulag. Admiral John Hudson, the former Judge Advocate General for the United States Navy, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Guantanamo Mess. Then finally, we'll examine the fate of immigration reform that could be derailed by Republican calls to halt debate on a bipartisan immigration reform bill in the Senate until issues relating to national security are answered. Shannon O'Neill, a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead, joins us to discuss President Obama's upcoming trip to Mexico and why immigration policies have failed so far. Joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who is a political scientist in the field of international relations as well as a scholar in the history of dance. He is recognized for his ideas concerning the banality of ethnic war and the theory that major world conflicts are quickly becoming obsolete. His books include Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, and Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda. He is currently the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University, and his latest book is Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. He also has an article at Slate, Why Didn't the Sennaro Brothers Carry Out Suicide Bombings? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And just to touch on your piece in Slate, because apparently there is new information about the Sennaro brothers' motivation, and as much as they, like a lot of other terrorists who've attacked the United States, it's not that they so much hate the United States as they hate U.S. foreign policy. Is that what's at play here? Because you've looked into the last 52 cases of terrorism here in the United States.
Yeah, what I've done is a case book written by students, which I then edited, of each of the 52 cases since 9/11, which has been Muslim extremist terrorism, which is targeted or pretty much targeted against the United States, whether they were based abroad, like the shoe bomber or the underwear bomber, or if they're based in the United States. And so it's possible to make a number of conclusions. One of the things that's really the Boston thing really stands out is different, is that these guys are actually able to make a bomb. No Islamist terrorist since 9/11 has been able to do that in the United States, make one and actually set it off. And that's mostly the case also in Britain, where except for the subway, the underground bombers in 2005, there no one set off a bomb there either. Anyway, the article then deals with various similarities, including what seems to be a fair amount of incompetence on the part of these guys, though they were able actually to make a bomb. But the issue that you brought up, and there's just been some confirmation of it in the Washington Post a few hours after the Slate thing was posted, was speculation about motivation. And what has frequently been come forward on this is somehow that people become extremely Islamist and more Islamist, and then eventually that leads them to being extremely religious and therefore violence. And so the implication, not always intended, is that if you become extremely religious, therefore you tend to turn toward violence. And when I looked at the 52 cases, what was clear, one of the things I wanted to examine was what motivated these guys, why did they do it? Overwhelmingly, the motivation was hostility toward American foreign policy in the Middle East, also American support for Israel and the Palestinian conflict. I wasn't surprised qualitatively, but I was really surprised quantitatively, because just about every case was like that. So you could say they became radicalized in the sense something ticked them off and put them in in the path toward violence, but it wasn't that they were super Islamic. In some cases, they were anything but, you know, they were not very religious people for the most part, but some of them, many of them were. But the thing really motivated them more than anything else, according to their own statements repeatedly, was this hostility to foreign policy. And then the question was that does this apply to the Boston bombers? And just a few hours ago, there's a front page or something posted on the Washington Post by Scott Wilson, Greg Miller, and Sarah Horwitz, in which they've been talking to the guy who's the remaining bomber. And what he says, insofar as he's able to say much of anything still, is that the motivation was very heavily because of hostility toward the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that if that proves holds up and this proves to be true, that's going to fit these other cases really quite closely, I think.
But clearly, Dr. John Mueller, first of all, in terms of the bomb making, given that this is extremely dangerous to do and these guys didn't blow themselves up. They may have been incompetent, but they managed to get bombs that worked. And they also managed to make sort of improvised hand grenades, which they tossed at the police. Those things are not easy to do, to be able to do an IED that doesn't blow up in your face. So there's some suspicion that maybe the older brother got some training when he was in Chechnya over the last he was 6 months there last year. On the other hand, we learn that the older brother, who seems to be the motivator here, he became religious and fairly radical in his religious beliefs as a result of somebody over here in the United States. So the idea that somehow Al-Qaeda indoctrinated him doesn't hold much water, at least from what I can see from the record.
Yes, that seems to be the case. It's not he was becoming increasingly religious, and that's not terribly unusual. The thing is, as he sinks more and more into his faith, the key thing that sets him off is not being in the faith, but finding that more and more resentment with what they seem to see as a war upon their co-religionists in the Middle East. So that's the motivating factor, not simply that they're becoming more religious. It's identification with the religion and saying my religion is being attacked. It's basically the idea in their minds is they're defending Islam. It's not that they're trying to establish caliphates or Sharia law throughout the world, as frequently has been argued. So it's somewhat different. I don't know how much training he had. The bombs are not all that complicated, and according to at least some information so far, and of course it's still quite early in terms of nailing this down, the recipe they used was in a jihadist handbook that was published online. It's a pressure cooker thing in which you put a bunch of nails and gunpowder in a pressure cooker and find a way to set it off, ignite it. So it's not terribly complicated, though it is, you're certainly right that many people trying to do this tend to, you know, the biggest person in danger is them.
The key to it is the trigger. If you have to have a certain amount of sophistication to be able to trigger these things in a way that you don't get blown up. You know, if it has a cell phone.
Both the bombs had died. But apparently one of the grenades or whatever he had blew up in the older brother's hand. So it wasn't exactly perfect. Sure. But the bomb making, I do definitely give them credit for. That was, you know, the first time anybody's been able to do that, except obviously not credit in the good sense, but, you know, that they were able to do that. But beyond that, they seemed to have had zero plan about how to escape. They just stayed in their apartment, and they apparently had no money and no clue, basically, what to do. And then eventually, when their pictures were published, they went on this rampage to try to steal money and steal a car and get out of there, apparently. And that was, of course, an incredible fiasco. So the stupidity was basically not thinking it through. What happens after the bombs go off? We can just sort of assume. They seem to just sort of assume they could just sort of go back to their normal lives and no one would notice they exist. Also, carrying it out at the place in the world that's probably the most photographed in the whole planet at that point in time. Right. Presumably, they've probably never thought about that either.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. He's the author of Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. And his latest book is Terror Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. He also has an article at Slate.com, Why Didn't the Sennaro Brothers Carry Out Suicide Bombings? Now, obviously, you know, we can't count on the incompetence of terrorists. You know, we got lucky with the Times Square guy. He was even more incompetent than these guys.
Yeah, he had a lot of training, too. He had 21 days of training.
Right.
Still screwed up.
But, you know, we have this vast this trillion-dollar Homeland Security operation going on here. And the FBI, and it looks like the FBI handed these people by the Russians, and somehow they dropped the ball. Is there going to be any kind of reckoning on the amount of money we spend vis-a-vis the results here in this war on terror?
Well, I expect in terms of intelligence, it's going to be the reverse. The criticism is we have to try harder and follow up every single lead, even more so than we're doing now. And so that's going to increase the cost if they do that.
But that's also going to be a threat to our – isn't that a threat to our civil liberties, that they're going to be, you know, finding ways to delve into what everybody reads and thinks?
Yeah, that's right. It's going to basically continue. And the threat – the demand, I think, is to make sure that no stone wherever it gets unturned. Basically, there's a, you know, TMI, too much information, just because of the way things have been going. They've massively increased the amount of material they've been going through so no one can really – pull it together in any coherent manner, it seems. In this particular case, I'm very disinclined to think that they screwed up. Basically, they had some suggestion that this guy might have been a Chechen terrorist somehow, and the Russians are worried about it. But if Chechen terrorists previously have always been involved with dealing with, you know, in Russia, they're not, if anything, they're pro-American comparatively. And so the idea that this is somehow extrapolated to the United States would be very questionable. Furthermore, if the current information is accurate, it would suggest that the Russian connection was basically completely irrelevant. They were not acting as Chechens. They were acting as sort of international Muslims for the reason that, for the same reason other people have committed terrorism in the act of in the name of Islam, because they're so outraged at American foreign policy in the Middle East. So it's the Chechen connection, which is somewhat tenuous anyway, since they came to the United States as fairly, you know, as children, may not hold very much water. So if the FBI gets in and the Russians complain about this guy who seems to be sort of radical and he's Chechen, that doesn't follow that you would find any incriminating evidence. And this is some time ago, and looks like he was mostly became more and more devoted and determined to do terrorism only after that.
Well, just in closing, Dr. John Mueller, are we again relying on the technological fix rather than on intelligence? I mean, the FBI, it's a law enforcement agency. It's not an intelligence agency. And you've got this vast, all these Beltway bandits made billions out of these vast computerized algorithms that the NSA and others developed to track terrorism. And it's also how they compile the hit lists for drone strikes. And my understanding from talking to people inside the intelligence community, they say it's just a huge boondoggle. It just doesn't work. And yet that's what they rely on. That's their front line.
Yeah, well, he certainly, you know, didn't call this, and insofar as this case has been called in, it had nothing to do with, you know, big-time intelligence gathering or anything. It had to do with somebody setting up bombs and a sort of drudging police work of putting all the potential videos and photographs together to try to identify who could have done it at this most photographed place on the planet. And then after they were set into the rampage and became cop killers, and in fact the first thing they did was kill a campus cop at MIT, the police then went into, you know, standard and certainly not new, let's get the cop killer mode. And they carried that out using the standard techniques that don't have very much to do with high-tech developments.
Well, John Mueller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. He is the author of Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. And his latest book is Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Cost of Homeland Security. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Guantanamo mess.
I'm sick and tired of hearing.